Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrent Studies. Of course, I am your host, Adam Lowther, along with Curtis McGiffin and Jim Petrosky, who are our panel of experts and, you know, discussants in this round table that is the NIDS View. Now, today we've got an interesting article that just came out. He's a mentor to myself and to Curtis, and it's an article by none other than Keith Payne, who is, you know, it's funny, as I talk to a lot of academics, that these traditional academics are not familiar with Keith Payne's work. And so I'm like, what? How have you never read Keith? He's the best thinker on nuclear issues out there. But you and I both have read his work, and many practitioners are familiar with him because he's had a great career. But he wrote an article at the National Institute for Public Policy in their information series called Deterrence and Arms Control, Ending the Deceptive, quote, Holiday from History. And it's a prescient article. It's something that we have discussed repeatedly on the NIDS View and in our other articles. But Keith nicely sort of sums it up. So, you know, really what he's saying is we've had this holiday from history that is now coming, you know, we Cold War ends, we, you know, get rid of what 95% of our nuclear arms, we stop building, we don't modernize, we allow the arsenal to age into a point where it's well beyond its service life. We're struggling to maintain it as is. And now we're struggling to modernize and just build new versions of the same types of systems we already have. And we did it all because of there was this almost uniform agreement across both Republican and Democrat administrations that the U.S. was going to get along with Russia. China was going to, you know, if we just hug the panda enough, the panda was going to become a Democrat and adopt free market economies, and everything was going to be great. And, you know, North Korea was going to see the error of its ways, and the Kim family were going to, you know, decide that they want to be part of a democratic Korea. And, you know, all these great things were happening if we just wanted it bad enough. And we were optimistic, and we showed the world we meant no harm, and we, you know, drove to disarmament if we just did those things. And we were idealistic enough, we could build this new world order that George H.W. Bush talked about. And then, of course, here we are, and it was all wrong. It was just dead wrong. And now the Russians and the Chinese have rearmed, and we're observing the arms race that they're already running. And then, of course, Keith points, you know, makes a good number of very discreet points about how we got things wrong. So, you know, this is a great point of discussion. Now, Curtis, you read the article. Were there some any more sort of scene settings
I read the article too. Just pointing that out. It made it sound like I didn't do anything. Okay. Go ahead, Curtis.
It's interesting. You assume I read the article. No, let me say. I read through this, and it really felt to me like Keith Payne, Dr. Keith Payne, was really trying to. Determine some sort of accountability for all of this malfeasance in our history, if you will, when it comes to nuclear deterrence. Let me just quote a little short part here, which I think is a good summary of your intro, Adam, and that was, and I'm quoting here from his piece, Washington's aging idealistic approach to enemies. Deterrence and arms control has had consequences entirely contrary to the optimistic promises made by its advocates in and out of government. Following the Cold War, President George H.W. Bush, this would be Bush 41, told us we were entering a new world order in which the rule of law would prevail in international relations and small powers would no longer fear larger powers. We can look back, unquote. We can look back at the 30 plus years since the end of the Cold War. And I mean, that history is replete with small powers being oppressed, invaded, and otherwise harassed by larger powers through all the instruments of power, not just military, economically for sure. It's been the go-to weapon for the West and specifically the United States for a large portion of that. And of course, we fought a 20-year war on terror here in the United States post 9/11, which really set a tone, I think, for how the world would not only see us, but how we would look to use the rules-based international order. And so this piece is of course, very eye-opening. I encourage all of our readers to take a look at it and understand it is a realist sort of assessing the faux pas of idealism and the way that the idealists have sort of governed our strategic nuclear deterrence policy geopolitically since 1992. And the report card is out, I suppose, and Dr. Payne doesn't give him a very good grade.
Well, the big challenge is that there is a report card, but there are no grades because there's no accountability. I mean, if you truly right. think about Washington, there is no accountability for failure in Washington. I would love, one of the things I've always wanted is I want to pass a law. I want Congress to pass a law that makes all elected officials fiduciaries, which means that they are legally required to act in the best interest, let's say, of the American people. And if they don't, they can be sued or prosecuted when they do not act in the best, if they act in their own best interest, as opposed to the public's best interest, they can be sued or prosecuted. And I want to see every program that is passed by Congress annually reviewed. And if it does not solve the problem it seeks to solve, so let's say, Lyndon Baines Johnson's war on poverty that was going to end poverty. And here we are with more people dependent upon government than when he started those programs, which is now more than 100% of total revenue by the federal government goes to entitlement and transfer payments. So those programs have objectively failed to do what they set out to. Therefore, let's get rid of them because they don't work. That would be accountability. And when it comes to foreign policy, we've not had any of it.
Well, Adam, I'm gonna throw a wrench in the system. I mean, Curtis said, well, this is an abject failure, and then you're of course pointing to these issues of economics, and today, of course, it's in the news, and we talk about this, and I won't take measure with should we evaluate whether a policy or program is actually meeting its requirements. However, let's talk about the requirements of deterrence. We talk about this all the time. And you say it's an abject failure, Curtis. The objective behind our nuclear deterrent is so we have great power wars. Okay. So let's apply that to the past. Okay. How many great power wars have we had since World War II?
None.
Your premise that nuclear deterrence is the only program that the federal, that I can think of that the federal government has spent money on that worked?
I'm saying that this program has done well. If you want to give it a passing or a failing grade, I use a pass fail because, you know, you're a liberal arts guy, so you probably guys didn't really have the ABCD thing. You had to pass fail, and fail meant you didn't show up at class. So I would say from a pass fail evaluation, Adam, this is a pass for our nuclear deterrent, regardless how many screw ups we've had, and especially the last 30 years. What say you?
No, I mean, I agree with you, but I, you know, I would love to see some accountability because Keith in his article said says that there are 8 fallacies that were adopted, you know, beginning with the George H.W. Bush administration. So this is not, this is bipartisan, you know, failure. Yeah,
very much.
Bipartisan failure, bipartisan idealism. And, you know, I would submit to you that really in the last 30 years, we've only ever had one realist administration.
Yes.
And that has been the Trump administration. H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, those were all idealists. So you've really only had one true, and he's sort of hated for his realism because not fun or pleasant.
Would you not make the argument that Reagan's first term was more realism and the second term was more idealism?
You could perhaps, but I mean, that was the Cold War. So, I'm just thinking since the end of the Cold War, when we've really dismantled an arsenal that we sort of now wish we had, you know, and how would that have changed Russia's calculation had we had a robust nuclear arsenal in Europe? Or how would it have changed the calculation if the U.S. never withdrew all of its nuclear weapons from South Korea? Or if, you know, we withdrew nuclear weapons many moons ago from Taiwan, but had we not done that, how would China think differently about would Xi Jinping say we are going to integrate Taiwan into China if there were nuclear weapons on Taiwan? So, you know, conflict is being bred because of a very clear perception on the part of our main adversaries that the U.S. doesn't have nuclear weapons in key places in the region. And you know, this has been, I would submit to you, it's a pretty resounding failure. And so when it comes to what Keith said in his article, he said, and this is his first of 8 fallacies, he says, and I quote, "China and Russia will rise cooperatively and peacefully find their place in the liberal international order if only Washington will cooperate in the process. The old realist history is over." That was one of the fallacies, this idea that we now live in this new cooperative era and that it's just going to be incumbent upon us to be good people and to help them become good, solid Democrats, small d Democrats. And, you know, that turned out to be completely and totally wrong. Any, you know, take from that, Jim? I mean, would you agree or disagree with, you know, sort of Keith's take? Because to me, it seems almost unquestionable that he's right.
Well, so there's a lot of this goes back to your earlier premise that, and I know some of it was tongue in cheek, but some of it is real in saying, well, you know, in the past, we thought everyone would get along because North Korea would become a democracy and then they would work with South Korea and China would become a democracy and become us and Russia. I don't care if they become a democracy. I don't care if they want to remain communist. They are their own sovereign entities, and they can. What I do, and the other piece of this, and I'll sort of poke at the Air Force a little bit. I used to work for the Air Force in a certain organization, and I went to my boss one time, and I said, you know, I really am bothered because I work 12, 14 hours, and then someone adds, you know, this extra training I have to do that doesn't matter. And I said that, you know, I don't understand about someone taking my time. And he looked at me square in the eye and said, no one ever said the Air Force cared about your time. Do the training. And so, you know, I was told to do it. But the same thing happens here in a premise. No one ever said that China, Russia, North Korea, Iran really cares one hoot about the rules-based international order. And if we make our decisions based upon, well, there's this rules-based international order and they're not on board, no kidding. I would say I would have guessed that before we had a rules-based international order based upon the premise that they are the organizations they are. That doesn't mean we can't get along. You like chocolate ice cream, I like vanilla ice cream. As long as you're not throwing your ice cream at me, I don't give a
hoot. But that's okay? but that's the point, though. The point, right. though, is that the idealist thought that there would be this transition in Russia and China and North Korea, and that the, you know, sort of the benefits of liberal economies in sort of the wealth creation that we absolutely know they create would bring about this transition to democracy and, you know, sort of personal liberty. That was a fundamental failure.
But I'm not disagreeing with that part. The failure, though, is in what we expected them to do, to all become democracies. I don't care what the failure was. That was the failure. The failure should have been that they would not take us on. And if they're going to take us on, guess what? We're going to be ready. And that's the problem, because we aren't, we decided we're not going to be ready because they're all going to be just like us. That's the piece of the failure I'm saying. I'm not saying fundamentally the history's wrong. I'm saying fundamentally the history was based upon the wrong premise. And that's why we're where we are. Do this all the time. We do this all the time as a country.
So his second premise was that, and this is a fallacy, is that concerns about Russian and Chinese geopolitical threats are hyperbole. Washington's behavior drives their fears and can ease them with altruistic signaling and behavior. And this, Curtis, this drives you and I crazy, that if we just demonstrate to the Russians and the Chinese that we mean no harm, and if we lead the way by, sort of instead of the axiom, weakness is provocative, which, weakness demonstrates that you mean no harm, was sort of the view. And it didn't work. It didn't work.
Well, I think this goes hand in hand with the first fallacy that Keith writes here. And that is that, China was brought into the World Trade Organization as an attempt to liberalize its government in hopes that democracy would spread and they would become more liberalized. And that has actually not occurred. We can look at history now and see that since they joined the World Trade Organization a week after 9/11 in 2001, their economy has exploded in tenfolds larger than ours have grown at the same time. And they've increased their belligerence, their military, their economic coercion, and their geopolitical influence around the world as a purpose. So they basically used liberal economic gestures as a weapon against us. And so essentially we have funded the building of these kinds of capabilities and this also goes to the point, Adam, that the idealists believe that everything other countries do is a reaction to us. And it gives no credit to the idea that they are their own sovereign entities making their own decisions. They may be influenced by what we do, but they are not they're not completely reactionary in that sense. And we're living that world now.
It's simple mirror imaging where
where
people look at Russia and China and Iran and North Korea and they say, well, I want to be wealthier and have a bigger house and a nicer car and I don't want to go out and fight wars, so they obviously must want the same things as I do.
That's right.
And it abjectly ignores and rejects the individual cultures, histories, religious and moral values that make up other great societies. I mean, Russia's a long enduring great society. China has a long enduring great society. Korea, has a long enduring great society, and they don't have the same sets of values and wants and aspirations that we do. And that's okay. But we have to accept that and stop mirror imaging.
Yeah, so I agree. And if, since I picked on the Air Force earlier, I was one of the Army guys, the mighty 44, that went to the Air Command and Staff College down in Montgomery, Alabama. And I was surprised we started doing strategic thinking. And along these lines, Adam, I thought it was interesting, a posit that was made by one of the faculty down there. And it was this: it's not that you do not understand how the enemy perceives you, and it's not how that you, your enemy doesn't perceive you well, but it's you don't perceive how the enemy perceives you. Okay. And it's exactly that. It's that we imprint on our adversaries, our ideas and morals. And going back to it, I have this issue, and people say, well, there's this rules-based international order. They don't give a hoot. So why are we using that as the bludgeon to make them work? Let's find what makes them function and respond, and let's use it. And I know what does that. We've talked about it in many of our podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, both in China, in Russia, these are, you know, honor-shame cultures. And in honor-shame cultures, it's pretty straightforward how you motivate people and how you will ensure that they, you know, fight you to the death. This isn't rocket science, but we don't have an honor-shame culture. And so because we don't have that honor-shame culture, we don't understand or care why others do and why they're motivated differently. Now, let me move on to the third point. And Keith says, the United States can safely retreat from a two-war standard because the history of the great power war is over. America can enjoy a continuing holiday from history, particularly in terms of defense spending and preparations. And he points out, and this is really important, he points out that in 1985, sort of near the end of the Cold War, we were spending 5.7% of the gross domestic product on defense. And that was a perfectly reasonable number. We were not straining under defense spending like the Soviet Union was. And debt was much, much lower. Today, we are spending 2.7% of GDP on defense. 2.7%.
That's half, right?
That's half. And, you know, it will go down to 2.3% if we continue on the current trajectory. So we will be one of the lower spending NATO members. And, you know, and what's interesting is what we did is we took the U.S. federal spending and we essentially exploded entitlement and transfer spending. That's what's really exploded. Shockingly, I was looking this up because I'm working on something else. One in five Americans today relies on Medicaid for their health care. One in four. It's 24%. One in four Americans relies on Medicaid for their health care coverage today. 11% of Americans rely on some sort of handout transfer payment. And that's caused, you know, domestic entitlement spending to explode. And if you look at the charts from, you know, 1985 to the present, you can see that where defense spending is crowded out as domestic spending and entitlements dramatically increase. And so, you know, this idea that we can't afford ICBMs, that we can't afford all this stuff. No, we can afford it. But you're going to have to move back to a more rational entitlement program that is limited and is, you know, not as expensive as what we have now.
Well, let me add to this. So this is, of course, one of the fallacies that Keith Payne points out. Right? He's advocating this. And the point here is that we needed a two-war strategy, but basically what that is a two major regional conflict, sort of force posture. We used to try to strive for this in the early 90s, and then it was a win-hold-win idea, which relied a lot on our nuclear weapons as part of that hold. And the problem here is that we spent so much money and service life on the equipment we had left fighting the war on terror, that really the whole of the DOD needs a refurbishment. If you recall, Adam, it wasn't just the nukes. There were F-15s falling out of the sky because their wings were coming off, 10 years ago and so forth. I mean, there was a lot of this. We've shortened the service life of a lot of our systems, burning holes in the skies to drop small diameter bombs. Giant bombers to drop because they had big loiter time. And so they're burning hours on their engines and on their airframes, which then forces we have to rebuild or replace sooner, perhaps, in some of these issues. And, to prosecute this war on terror in an idealistic manner, by the way, as we're referring to this idea, right, the nation building and all these sorts of things. A realist nation would have bombed the hell out of the place and left, right? So it is the idealism that ends up costing the time, the money, and the effort that goes along with it. I like to think when we look at the war on terror, realists were really accountable for the first year, and possibly idealists were responsible for the other 19.
Yeah, and you made a great point. You've made this point several times, is that anytime you go and fight a war, you pay twice.
That's right.
You pay for the war, and then pay for recapitalization.
That's correct.
On all the stuff you lost up.
Yeah. That's right.
Sorry. Go ahead, Jim.
No. But going back to the two-war standard, and it brought out in this third bullet of Keith Payne's, I would argue that the concept comes from the great success of our nuclear deterrent. So we sometimes, when you're really successful, you forget what brings you here. And I think that's part of what we've done from this idealist view. Like, oh, we're not going to have great power wars anymore. That's because we shouldn't be a strong military nation. Well, what brought us here from the 1950s and 40s and 30s that puts us in a place where we don't see great power wars, or we don't think we're going to have great power wars because we have our nuclear deterrent? It's sort of it's one of these things where, nuclear weapons seem to contradict themselves. They're so powerful, you don't want to use them. They're so difficult to build that they're inherently safe. I mean, there's all these issues associated with them that make them sort of a contradiction in terms. But here, great power war's over. Why? Well, because we have our nuclear deterrent. We get rid of it. Guess what? Take that off the table and bullet-free changes. So it's sort of interesting when you talk to the disarmament community that they don't see that contradiction.
Yeah, it's a good point. And, with it's 1945 to the present. The world's population has tripled. The world's population has tripled only because we have reduced and eliminated great power war, which has, we've seen more people leave poverty since 1945 than in all of human history combined. This has been the greatest period of the growth of prosperity in human history. Technology, and why? Defense spending across the board has gone down. Remember, in World War II, the U.S. was spending between 40 and 50% of its entire GDP just to fight that war. And then you have to rebuild after war, and that's expensive. But when you eliminate great power wars, World War I, World War II, what do? You take all that capital that you would have spent blowing stuff up and rebuilding it, and now you go and you build things, and you bring people out of poverty, and you increase education. You do all the things that make people wealthier. There's more capital because taxes are lower. There's now more capital for things like Google to get off the ground, and Apple, and you name it, because you're not having to fight wars. So therefore, there's capital in the private sector that can then go do these things that make prosperity increase and technology grows. And, it's really quite something. Okay. Yeah. So
you also missed the other.
We're not going to get through
your population. your population comment, Adam, is, and there's time to go out and make babies. I just wanted to
point that out. Yeah. Well, so here's what we're going to do. So we're at the 29 minute mark and we're a 30 minute show. So what we're going to do is I'm going to use executive privilege here. And we're going to we're going to record a two-part show on the fly. That's what we're going to do. We're going to record a first part, and then we're going to record a second part, and part two will be the week after. So for those of you listening, you're going to have to listen 2 weeks in a row to hear this thing, because this is actually a great conversation
right.
that you hate to just cut off halfway through, because it's like one of those movies where it ends and you're like, that's a terrible ending. You don't bring it to a conclusion. It's like you ran out of money, and so you know the production company just ended it. So we're not going to do that to you. We're going to finish the whole thing. And so what we'll do now, we'll talk about point number four, and then, you know, we'll end the show, but we're actually going to go ahead and continue and record the second part. Okay, so let's get through point number four.
All right.
And this is, Keith says, and I'm quoting him, assured U.S. societal vulnerability to enemy strikes is desirable because unmitigated U.S. vulnerability assures enemies, stabilizes deterrence, and halts the arms race. This is, of course, a fallacy. And so this was one of his points. Jim, take on that fallacy?
I'm going to open all my doors and get rid of all my protection because that'll keep my neighbors at bay.
What?
Right.
Well, it's an interesting point, because what this sort of like what you're saying, it made me think, oh, well, crime has gone down. Well, let me start leaving my doors unlocked.
That's right.
I'll get rid of the cameras and I'll get rid of the guard dog because crime went down. So let's make no efforts now.
And you'll save a lot of money not having all that stuff out there to guard your other stuff. Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
I've heard this argument so many times, and everyone likes to, you know, wish it into place. And that's the best way to say it. They want to wish it into place. But human nature does not lead us to this conclusion, going back to what I had said before. Our adversaries don't give a hoot about the rules-based international order. You know, your local crime syndicate doesn't really care that you really, really like your cardboard Taylor Swift stand-up that you have in your living room, Adam.
It's pretty sweet.
Yeah, I know, but they don't care that you really like that, okay? That's not part of this. And we have got to start looking at it. So I like that fallacy pointed out here because it shows, it points back to the stability and instability caused by weakness, which we talked about, by the way, in our last episode.
Okay, Curtis? Thoughts from you?
Yeah, because this is a big one. This idea of assured vulnerability, you know, we know we learned in the 90s after the fall of the wall and the Russians and the Americans start talking that the Russians when they were the Soviets, never subscribed to the mutual vulnerability idea, right?
They just didn't.
And in fact, they didn't understand why Americans were doing that. It didn't compute for them. Why would you leave your society vulnerable? And so the idea that as long as they were assured that they could hit us, that there would be deterrence. And we lived under this idea, the idealists believed, well, we have the way, we're assured that we can get there because we don't want to believe anything else. So we sort of had this sort of agreement, right? Yeah, you lie to us and we pretend you're not lying to us and that sort of thing. And so we live that life. And we see today now as the world gets enraged over President Trump's American Iron Dome strategy, which we talked about in a podcast, I think two podcasts ago.
Yeah.
You see the mutual vulnerability doves sort of poke their heads out and go, oh, you're putting that at risk. I assure you the Chinese are not building a massive amount of nuclear weapons in order to enjoy some sort of mutual vulnerability.
Yeah.
And neither are the Russians seeking that in their novel weapons that they're building in moving forward. They are building weapons to meet their national interests, and vulnerability of their society is not one of their national interests, I assure you.
Yes. Yeah, it's a fair point. It's a fair point. Now, here's what we're going to do. We've gone through four of his 8 points, and he has recommendations, which we haven't even discussed those yet. Because I know, Curtis, you've got some take issue with Keith on the Rex about what he wants to do. So what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and end the show here, and then we're going to keep recording and record the second half of this. So Curtis, Jim, thanks. It's good to be here. It's great.
We hope to see you all next week or hear you all next week or hear us next week.
And of course, thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of the NIDS View. And remember, check us out, Global Security Review. If you're an aspiring author or you're a practitioner, but you're not 100% certain, hey, I've never really written much, give it a shot. Send a draft to me. I'll help you craft it into a great article that really speaks to others and, you can be proud of. So hit us up at Global Security Review. Curtis is tweeting at what's our Twitter handle?
Think Deterrence. At Think Deterrence is our handle.
At Think Deterrence on X. And then, we've got a Peter Husey events, twice a month at least. We've got all kinds of stuff coming up.
Great speakers on that thing.
Yeah, great speakers. We've got Frank Miller and Madeline Creedon, and we've got Dave Trachtenberg's coming, and we've got Mark Schneider, and it's going to be a great set of speakers. So make sure to look at the schedule for that. You can always go to nids@thinkdeterrence.com and try and get on our list, and we'll send you upcoming events and stuff.
That's an email address, by the way.
Yeah, that's an email address. nids@thinkdeterrence.com. You can reach us anytime, anywhere. Yeah. We're open 24 hours a day.
Right.
But if you want to just look at our website, it's at thinkdeterrence.com. Just want to make that clear for our listeners.
Okay, so thanks for listening to the show. We're going to go ahead and stay, and we're going to record the second part. But as we end this first episode, we, as always, want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.